Short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. One of the things we keep hearing about in the state response to new COVID-19 cases is the importance of testing and tracing. We've talked a lot about how testing works, and more than 90,000 people have been tested in Vermont. But what about tracing? What actually happens when someone contacts you to let you know you may have been exposed to the novel coronavirus? In a few minutes, we're going to have our weekly health update to get all of your questions answered about mask policy, about the state's response to COVID-19, and about the return to school in the fall with the health department. But first, we're going to walk through the process of tracing and hear what it's like to be a contact tracer. We're joined by Shayla Livingston. Shayla is a public health policy advisor for the Department of Health, and she's also been tapped to do some of the state's contact tracing. Shayla, nice to talk with you. Thanks for being willing to explain the process.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
How did you actually get this job? Is that just something that if you work in the health department, you have to be expected to do?
Yeah, so many of us are doing jobs that are not our usual jobs. We are organized through a health operations center. And so in March, when they were deploying different people throughout the department, this was the role that they gave me, along with many of my colleagues.
Did you want it? Are you okay with it?
I was more than happy to help. In that moment, we were definitely feeling the urgency and everyone was ready to pitch in and willing to pitch in. I was excited by it. I had never done it before. Contact tracing is something that the health department does and has done for decades here in Vermont. It's done all over the world. But sort of like maybe some of the listeners, I vaguely knew what it was, and I knew from some epi courses I'd taken, but I had never done it. And so it was exciting in many ways, and I have enjoyed it, I think, overall.
Okay, so what is the training like? What do you actually get trained in knowing what to do and how to do it and how to protect privacy and what it is you're supposed to say?
Sure. So I think the big thing is to know that with contact tracing, the purpose is to partner with the individual who has the disease that you are trying to contain and work with them to determine the best way and the safest way for them to recover and stop the virus from spreading. So for me, in my day-to-day job, I'm working on policy in Montpelier, and the people who train me are often social workers, and they do this work again every day. And they, I think, are part of the reason that Vermont has had the success we've had with contact tracing, because in their training, they really emphasize empathy and compassion and listening and open-ended questions and the value that that brings in terms of getting really good information and helping to support the individual where they are. And we were all trained by them. And I think that in Vermont, that makes a big difference because it really improves our ability to understand where people are and, again, contain the spread.
So walk me through. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I just wanted to address the privacy thing. The big thing around privacy that's so important is knowing HIPAA. And it, at the health department, we are all trained in HIPAA and patient privacy. But one of the really interesting things and important things is that when you're contacted by a tracer because you've been exposed to COVID-19 through an individual, we don't disclose that person's name. So we just give you the date and we give you the information. So that's an important privacy piece that some people are surprised by.
So could we role play for a moment, Shayla, and pretend you have to call me because you have discovered that I may have been exposed? What would you say? How would you call me? How would I know that you're legit?
Sure. So I would first start by validating that you are Jane Lindholm. So I'd say, hello, this is Shayla Livingston. I'm calling from the Vermont Department of Health. I'm looking for Jane Lindholm.
I am Jane Lindholm.
Hi, Jane. I'm calling because the health department is calling all individuals who have been exposed to somebody who tested positive for COVID-19. And unfortunately, you were exposed last Thursday. And I just want to walk through with you what that means for you, give you some information, and answer any questions you have. Is now an okay time to talk?
Yes, but now I'm freaking out.
Yeah, it can be scary, but I think some important things for you to know are that if we work together, you can both access any medical assistance that you need, and also that many people who are exposed do not actually end up contracting the illness. And those who do end up contracting the illness, for many of them, the symptoms can be mild. So let's just start with your exposure. You were exposed last Thursday, and today is Tuesday. So what we ask of people who are exposed is that they quarantine, which means you stay home and you don't go out to grocery shop or do other errands or see other people for 2 weeks from the date of your exposure. Are you able to do that? Do you need assistance either with food or rent or getting groceries or medications?
Yeah. I mean, I was supposed to go to the pharmacy today. I have medication I need to take every day. I mean, can I even pick up my kids this afternoon?
Yeah, those are great questions. So what we're going to do is just walk through the things that you have to do today and then think about how we can plan for them going forward. Do you have any friends or family who you feel comfortable having pick up your medications?
Yes. Yeah, I do. But do I have to tell them that I've been exposed? Are they exposed?
That's a great question, too. No. So you are a contact of a case. They would be a contact of a contact. So they are not considered exposed and they are not at risk at this time. If you develop symptoms or if you end up testing positive, then we might have to work with them as well as contacts. But for right now, they are not considered contacts and they are not at risk. They can go and pick something up for you at the pharmacy. We'd ask that they drop it off outside your house. They can go and get your kids. And your kids actually weren't exposed to this person. And so they, even though they live with you, are also contacts of a contact. And they're okay as well.
And seen. Thank you. That was so informative because, you know, I think a lot of people who haven't been contacted by a contact tracer just, you know, there's curiosity and there's some trepidation. Like, what would that actually be like? What questions am I going to be asked? What am I going to be allowed to do or not do? What have people you've actually contacted said to you or how have they responded?
Vermonters have been amazing. For the most part, people are definitely happy to quarantine. I'm not happy, that's not the right word. They're willing to quarantine and they understand the importance of it. They are willing to share information about who they've been in contact with. They understand the importance of providing that information when they're a positive case. It's really that part of it. I think, again, this community has responded in a really positive way. I've had a couple of, there's the very sad and devastating connections you make with people. Because it's part of this whole thing, I get a list of names who are the positive cases, and that's how you start your day.
So you start by calling the positive
cases.
One?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's how you get the list of names. It's from those cases and working with them and walking through their contagious period and who they could have been exposed to. And so those are the conversations that have been harder in some instances because people are very sick. Again, I'm not a provider. I don't normally work one-on-one with people in that kind of, you know, counseling or clinical sense. And I've had the experience of talking to somebody and then a week later finding out from a provider that they have passed away. And that is incredibly emotional and in many ways very draining and exhausting. It feels like, you know, failure. And it's hard. The context, it's less like that. There's, you know, luckily many of them don't actually end up getting sick. And those conversations are easier. There are some that can end up being long conversations to try to get somebody to where you need them. Oftentimes that can be sometimes with younger people. I've had experiences with group housing where it's a bunch of roommates who don't really know each other and somebody gets sick And then they've all got to stay inside in their apartment all together for 2 weeks.
And that is challenging.
Conversations. Yeah, they can be challenging. Also, just, you know, you go through several iterations. Oh, okay, I get it. I can't go out, but I'll still go to work. Nope, you can't go to work. Okay, you know, and back and forth and just sort of working through the pieces until you get them to a place where they feel like they can stay home and understand what it means.
And in fact, I think you've talked to a beekeeper who said, well, how am I going to check on my bees, which is a unique challenge.
Yes, that's right. I did talk to a beekeeper. And farmers and beekeepers, there's a number of individuals when you get to the questions about their profession and whether they can stop work, you know, how am I going to handle these unique situations? And, what's the harm reduction piece that you can do with behavior? You know, with farming, it's tricky. We don't want people picking vegetables, for example, if they're ill, and yet we don't want the vegetables rotting. And so trying to figure out how they can get the assistance they need and make sure that they are in a place where they really can isolate and quarantine, because I think an important part of public health is not just telling somebody to do something, because that doesn't necessarily work. I mean, your kids are a great example. How do I go pick up my kids? I'm not going to tell you you can't go pick up your kids. So I want to get you to a place where you have a plan that we both feel like you can actually do, so that I feel secure that you're going to quarantine or isolate, and that you feel like you can continue to live your life and meet your obligations.
Well, that's so interesting, because you said right at the beginning that when you call someone, you're a team with them. You think of yourself as sort of in a partnership with the people that you're getting in touch with.
Yes, because this is about cooperation. And, you know, the things that I, again, was taught by the folks who trained me, you know, is really digging into that compassion and that empathy and meeting them in the place where they are, because we're relying on them to do this. And it is only through their behavior that we are able to contain the virus. And being, you know, heavy-handed and just kind of dictatorial is probably not going to get you as far.
In your normal day job, you're a public health policy advisor. Has doing this contact tracing work given you different insight into the lives of your fellow Vermonters that you think might benefit you in your regular job?
That's a great question. I think that it has informed so much about the way that I understand public health communication. And that's not necessarily something I use every single day, but it's a really important part of public health and how we communicate and what people have understood from what we've said through either the commissioner who's, you know, on the press conferences every week or through our social media campaigns or other communications we've done. It's really brought home for me how important the clarity is, how important that messaging is, and when we get it right, when we get it wrong, what that can mean for Vermonters. I think that's been a really, really important lesson for my job going forward.
Shayla Livingston is one of the people doing contact tracing for the state of Vermont, and she's a public health policy advisor for the Department of Health. Shayla, thank you for giving us some insight into this contact tracing work. I appreciate it.
Thank you again for having me.
As we heard more about in this morning's briefing from Governor Scott and members of his administration, a statewide mask mandate goes into effect in 4 days on August 1st. This mandate requires Vermonters to wear a mask indoors in public spaces, and it also requires a mask outdoors when 6-foot distances can't be maintained. It does make exceptions for those exercising outdoors, for kids under the age of 2, those who have difficulty breathing, and people who can't wear a facial covering due to a medical or developmental condition. Vermont now joins the majority of other U.S. states in this kind of mandate. By last count, 31 states and the District of Columbia have some kind of mask requirement, including Vermont. We'll talk a little bit about that today and answer other questions you might have about COVID-19 and health issues. Today's press conference also focused on the return to in-person education for Vermont students. Many districts that have come out with plans so far are actually going with a hybrid plan where students are only in the school building a couple of days a week. Lots of questions still remain about how that's going to work if school districts will have sufficient staffing for that to be able to open. I encourage you to listen to yesterday's Vermont edition for more on what superintendents are thinking and the responses from the Agency of Education Secretary Dan French. But in terms of the health considerations going into school reopening, we can take questions on that today as well. We're joined once again by the Health Department's Deputy Commissioner, Tracy Dolan. Tracy, thanks as always for being here.
Thanks, Jane. Always good to be here.
Tracy, we were just talking with Shayla Livingston, who's one of the contact tracers for the state of Vermont and also works for the Department of Health. I want to ask another question about contact tracing. I'm wondering, when the Health Department thought about and continues to think about who is doing this contact tracing, are there any standards or goals for diversity in hires for contact tracers? I mean, is sort of cultural understanding and sensitivity something that you think about when you're calling various people around the state and really delving into their lives? So is there a diversity of contact tracers?
That's a great question. We actually haven't been hiring people to do contact tracing. We have mostly sourced them from within our staff. And we do think about the diversity as much as we can in terms of the diversity of our staff. But we have not hired outside folks to do the contact tracing. It's been helpful to have people with a public health background. And so that's who we've used. And it's been a little bit easier technology-wise because of the platforms and some of the IT processes and programs that we use to have them from within our system in terms of the technology side. And so that's what we've done. But the diversity piece and the communication and the cultural communication and sensitivity is really important. And so we are dedicating considerably more funding and energy to that outreach. So right now, for example, we are in the midst of programming and making decisions about some funds that were appropriated to us through the legislature under the Corona Relief Funds to do just that, to get out, to support more case management where there are cases, to enhance the work of the contact tracers where needed, to do the primary prevention and just communicate and connect more with more diverse communities in Vermont.
So are you doing different kind of training then for the people who are doing contact tracing to be able to do that kind of work and work within diverse communities?
So for our contact tracers, they are primarily just doing that initial outreach. But for this other group that I'm talking about, more like community health workers, those would be sourced from organizations around the state who in many cases may have lived experience or already work with those populations. So that's what we're programming and planning right now, with the expectation that we will move that funding and that support out very soon.
I see. So it's two different groups of people.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
So let's talk a little bit about the mask mandate, the governor's mask mandate, which he announced last week. It goes into effect on August 1st. And so can you go through just the basic parameters of when Vermonters are required to wear masks?
Sure. I can even read it right from the executive order here.
Perfect.
So as of Saturday, August 1st, Vermonters shall wear masks or cloth facial coverings over their nose and mouth anytime they are in public spaces, indoors or outdoors, where they come into contact with others from outside their households, especially in congregate settings where it's not possible to maintain a physical distance of at least 6 feet. So that's the general order.
Right. And so just to reiterate, it applies both to both indoor settings and outdoor settings if people cannot maintain a 6 foot distance.
That's correct. That's correct. We have some exemptions here for anyone under the age of 2. They don't have to wear it. People who are engaged in strenuous exercise or activity, a child or adult with a medical or developmental issue or challenge that would be complicated or irritated by facial covering, or anyone with difficulty breathing.
And that's not going to be policed, as I understand it. So if you say, I have a medical condition that prevents me from being able to wear a mask, a retail establishment can't say, where's your doctor's note?
I mean, I don't know if a retail establishment could ask that, but certainly this mandate doesn't require any documentation. I don't know the rules on whether or not an establishment on their own, with their own private rules, can choose who can be in their store or not in terms of facial coverings. But I do know that as a state mandate, we wouldn't require that.
There was a question in the press conference today that came up where apparently a Vermonter was asking if there's a wedding, And so it's not a public setting exactly, but it may be a rental, you know, a tent rental or something. Are people who are congregating, but maybe congregating in a private, more private setting than, you know, just a restaurant, will they be required to wear masks? And I was interested to hear, and maybe even a little surprised to hear Governor Scott say, yes, the mandate applies. Even if you're in a relatively private setting like a wedding, if you cannot maintain a 6-foot distance, you will be expected to wear masks. Could you clarify that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I will just back up whatever the governor said there.
Well, he just said yes. And so I was like, wait, yes. Yes, what? I was wondering if I misheard or, you know, what that
I think
means.
When the governor, I think in the mandate, when they call out public spaces, what they're doing is differentiating between that and someone's home. But I think that a wedding in a place that you rent could still be considered a public space. But clearly I'm starting to go way out of my range into Lawyerville. But I believe that's what the governor's getting at. It's a congregate setting in a space that's outside of someone's home or backyard or patio. And I think the spirit of what we're trying to do is keep the transmission down.
Yeah.
And so the spirit of this is to please wear masks, especially when you've got groups coming together outside of your small family gathering in your home.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that because, you know, there's the letter of the law and then there's the spirit of the law. And then there's the data that backs up the law. Or I guess it's not really a law, right? This is a mandate. It's a rule.
A mandate. It's an executive order. Yes.
So what data is there that either confirms or even suggests that wearing a mask is a good enough method in helping to prevent the spread of COVID-19 that it supports a mandate from the governor?
The data is now present in numerous studies, and those are provided by the CDC. So if you go to the CDC website under facial coverings, you can now unearth many studies that they list there. And the studies, most of them quite new, from 2020 onward, but also some older studies indicate that wearing masks, and particularly when most people wear masks, so there's a herd effect, it does decrease transmission. Good enough is an interesting point. Probably nothing is perfect. We're not saying this is 100% at all, but we are seeing now what appears to be evidence, not just in the lab, but in real practice, where mask wearing appears to be the game changer in some other countries, in some other communities where they've been able to open up and not see a surge in cases that they would have in other places that didn't have a mask mandate or didn't have widespread mask use. Again, it's emerging science, but what we know so far tells us that of all the tools in our toolbox, this is a very important one.
Michael is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking the call. I basically just wanted to state that I don't approve of the exemption for strenuous activity. I go to a gym, or I've ceased going to a gym here in Manchester. Going to a gym is a huge part of my life. Love to feel strong, get strong, and physical activity, like I said, is so important to me. But if we're going to have this policy of wearing masks, to have an exception for strenuous activity. So my experience, it doesn't make sense because it is the place to spread COVID. You know, I bench press, there are people next to me running, and I have been wearing a mask the entire time during my strenuous activity, but I seem to be the only one. And my basic question is, what is the point if we're in an unventilated room where people are coming all day and huffing and puffing and putting all these particles in the air? If anyone who has COVID in there, they're going to spread it to everybody. And so the exception seems to me counterproductive to the statewide mandate.
Michael, thanks for your call. And Tracy Dolan, could you first clarify, there is an exemption to mask wearing for strenuous exercise, but does that only apply outdoors?
It doesn't state in the requirements if it applies outdoors or indoors, but I would say it's an exemption, but it doesn't mean we don't think you should do it. If people can wear masks during their strenuous activity, especially inside, especially if they can't distance, we would highly recommend mask use, particularly if they're inside a gym and you can and you're not spaced appropriately. Absolutely, you should wear a mask. But there may be some people for a combination of reasons who are unable to do that. And in those cases, we're saying you don't have to. I think the key here is there's a few things that I would pull back on, because I think when we go right down to an individual who might not be wearing a mask, it can feel high risk. But if we pull ourselves up a little bit to the 5,000 foot view, I never know which 1,000 foot that saying is. I think it is
30,000.
I don't know.
I think it's 30,000.
There we go. It's 30. I just brought it down to 5. Okay. I would say
you're using small planes, small aircraft.
I am. So I would say, remember that the reason we're able to do a lot of what we're doing right now in some of the reopening is because Vermont is unique in the country with a very low prevalence and incidence rate right now of COVID-19, very unique in the country. And so that's one piece. If we were in a different state, if we were in a different state of this disease right now and we had a lot more infection, things would look a lot different. And we may not even have some of these exemptions, but we are in a situation where that is our first safety right there. We're mostly among other Vermonters living in this state, mostly low risk, mostly people who do not have the virus. I mean, the vast majority don't. And then the second piece is, of course, these are exemptions, but we're not saying don't. We're saying if you can't, it's an exemption that we would allow.
But to Michael's point, I mean, if you're indoors exercising and there are suggestions that people who are strenuously exercising and exhaling deeply may be spreading the virus farther than people who are breathing more normally. Yes, it may be understandable that wearing a mask while you're exercising strenuously is difficult, but if you're going to go to an indoor gym and exercise, why allow that exemption when it there may be signs that the spread could actually be enhanced in an atmosphere like that?
Yeah, I would say, again, we recommend it, but it is one of the allowable exemptions. And I do think that probably when people are thinking about not wearing a mask during strenuous activity, the thought is probably that this particularly applies outside. But again, I won't second guess on that. According to the executive order, it seems that it would allow for inside as well. But again, we recommend that you wear a mask if you can.
Yeah, and it is a little bit confusing because the governor's addendum, the executive order, does not specify indoors or outdoors. But if you look at the governor's own press release, it says some of the exemptions are for outdoor exercising. And so it's a little bit unclear. So maybe we can get some clarity on that moving forward, you know, as
sure.
This goes into place.
Yeah.
And let's go to Matthew, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Matthew.
Hello, yes. Thank you for taking my call, Jane. I was just calling in reference to workplace, outdoor workplace break zones. Would that be considered an area in which would fall underneath the mandate? And I'll take
yes,
my question off the air. Thank you so much.
So, Matthew, did you hear that, Tracy Dolan? You said yes, it would apply.
Yes, it would. Yes. Yeah.
With the exception that if you can maintain a 6-foot distance, you are not required to wear a mask outdoors in a break zone.
That's correct.
Yeah. A lot of those break zones are where people take a smoke break. So, you know, again, that would be an instance where, you know, you'd have to be able to maintain a 6-foot distance in order to put your mask down and take a smoke break.
Yes. So I think the outside break area, if you can maintain 6 feet, the mask isn't required. If you can't, the mask is required.
Regardless of
activity.
Speaking of smoking, Paul in Bridport says, I'd like to ask about a possible link between smoking and vaping and virus spread. It seems obvious to me that smoke might carry virus from the smoker's lungs, but there may be a good reason why this is not a vector for the transmission of the virus. If this is a problem, we should know about it so we can protect ourselves from this possible transmission medium. If it's not a problem, we should know why it's not. So is it a problem or isn't it? And what is the science behind either possibility, Paul asks.
Yeah, I think we actually got this question a couple of months ago, too.
Mm-hmm.
Another caller called in. And as far as we know, smoke does not transmit the virus. Smoke from a cigarette, smoke from vaping. It's possible that not enough, even if you were infected, it's possible that not enough of the virus would be present in the outgoing smoke. But as far as we know, there's no science that says that being in the presence of a smoker who is infectious would be the cause. I think it would be even tricky to know regardless, because if you were in the presence of someone smoking who wasn't wearing a mask, who was infectious, and you became ill, it would be very hard to know if you got that from the smoke or simply from the transmission of the person breathing. But there is no evidence right now that smoking is transmitting. We do know that smoking is a complicating factor. It decreases your health status, and it is one risk factor for having a more severe illness.
And you know, and yes, to clarify, when you're smoking and you exhale the smoke may not transmit the virus, but you're still exhaling, so the droplets
That's
from
right.
your mouth could still transmit the virus.
Yes. Yeah.
In the mask mandate, one of the things that it that changes is that it has now a requirement for children above the age of 2 to also be masked, be wearing a facial covering in these kinds of environments. Does that then change the policy for camps and daycares, which are currently not required to have small children wearing masks? Starting August 1st, are 3-year-olds in their preschool and 6-year-olds at their camp going to be required to wear a mask, or do camps and daycares get to follow the policy that they established at the beginning of the summer?
That's a great question. And one part of kind of looking behind the curtain of all of this policymaking that you're seeing in Vermont is that because we're doing this at very rapid speeds, you wouldn't normally see in blue sky time, you wouldn't normally see policies coming out this quickly. So one of the outcomes is that sometimes then we have to go back and make quick adjustments. So we are talking now, every time that policy comes out, we look at all the other policies and we see, do we need to align them? Are we going to let a policy stand? So this is an example where we'll go back and see, does that current policy stand? Is there a reason that it would make sense or continue to make sense for kids in childcare? There is a difference between a 3 or 4-year-old who goes into the grocery store wearing a mask and comes back out versus a 3 or 4-year-old all day wearing a mask. And so that is one key difference here. So it is possible that we'd allow that policy to stand in terms of childcare, but still ask in this temporary, more short-term way where kids are out going into a grocery store or where kids are in a crowd, that it would make sense for them to wear a mask, given that it's unlikely that they're doing that for 8 hours a day every day.
So TBD on whether on the,
yes.
the policy, but in terms of children, you know, the idea that children may be asked to wear a mask if they go into the grocery store, isn't one of the complicating factors or the ways that transmission risk is increased is the longer you spend in the presence of someone who has the virus.
That's
so
right.
Allowing children to not wear masks for 8 hours in a childcare setting seems to increase the possible. I mean, again, lots of factors here. We know that young children, so far, we seem to know that young children are less likely to transmit the virus. But that question of a short burst in a grocery store, yes, wear a mask if you're 5, 8 hours with your cohorts and your teachers, don't wear a mask seems.
I think the key is the cohort there. You're going into a grocery store, you're around all kinds of other people, right? And so you're being impacted maybe by the other folks that they have been around, but you're in your cohort at childcare. We treat some of these cohorts like a family or like a pod almost, and then you're consistently interacting with 2 or 3 adults. There's more protection because you have a limited number of people that you're regularly interacting with. And of course, we know that children are generally lower risk, but going into a grocery store, going into a crowd where you don't know people and there are a variety of different people, that risk may even be higher even in the short term than the risk of a child being in one place for 8 hours a day with a group that they've been with.
Another question on masks. Naomi says, I'm concerned about the mask mandate. My nose is problematic at the best of times, and I've found it very hard to breathe through a mask. This will affect anything I need to do that will require that I be masked for more than about 10 minutes. Unfortunately, when Governor Scott mandated the use of masks, he didn't also mandate that my nose work, too. You know, I've been hearing a lot of people talk about, you know, those who cannot wear masks for one reason or another or find masks really uncomfortable. Some people saying, well, find somebody else who can go to the grocery store for you. If you can't wear a mask, you shouldn't be at the grocery store. You know, various responses to that. How do you advise people who, you know, either can't wear a mask and are worried about what this means for them or find it very problematic to wear a mask, even if it's not a physical impossibility?
You know, I actually find it pretty uncomfortable myself wearing a mask, mm-hmm. and I've tried a few, and that helps to try a different type. So one thing I would say is try different ones to see if there's one that's more comfortable. The other is that if you can be in an environment where you don't have to wear it all day, then you might want to shorten those bursts. But generally, we're asking you to wear one. However, there is an exemption that if for some reason you absolutely can't, then we'd encourage you to take less risk and offer less risk to others by limiting the amount of time you're among others. I mean, the reality is it's going to be a few people who can't. And if they can do whatever they can to make it happen or whatever they can to provide distance, that would be helpful.
For some of the people who are saying if you medically can't wear a mask, you shouldn't be going grocery shopping. To be clear, that's not what the state is asking.
That is not what the state is asking. Nope. We would suggest that you may want to limit your time out if you medically can't wear a mask, both for your own protection and for others. But we're certainly not saying you should go get all of your needs and you should go in where you need to go in. But just like all of us, we're encouraging people not to linger where they don't need to be. And particularly if you can't wear a mask, you may want to shorten them out that time. But again, there is an exemption for people who cannot wear one.
Tracy Dolan, there was a lot of conversation, a lot of comments in the press conference earlier today about the return to education in the fall. The state is now mandating, Governor Scott is going to come out with another executive order that says that the start date for Vermont schools will be September 8th, Tuesday, September 8th, no sooner than that. And Secretary of Education Dan French said it's still to be determined whether that also applies to independent schools, not just Vermont's public schools. But that extends the preparation time that schools and families should have in getting ready for the return to school. But there were also a lot of comments from the speakers in the press conference today about the value of in-person education, particularly for younger students and for those with developmental disabilities who may need in-person instruction at a higher degree than some of the older students who could possibly do independent instruction in a different way. But there were no changes to the policy. So I'm curious about that messaging. Who is it for? I mean, I get it. You're not the governor. You didn't set the policy here. Mm-hmm. But as part of the health department, what the messaging is out there, there's no change in state policy about whether schools are required to offer in-person instruction. And in fact, many districts have already put out their plans. So why the emphasis now on the value of in-person instruction when so many districts have already decided?
I think as we look at our rates in Vermont and we continue to have low rates, as we see that there has been a tourist season and we're in the middle of it now and we still haven't seen a surge, we are hopeful at the health department that when with students, those who do go back in September, as we move through, hopefully if we continue to see this low activity, we are hopeful that we can move more and more toward kids being back in the classroom and make that adjustment. So one of the reasons that we're really trying to promote this information is to get people thinking about that. Some schools may be able to make adjustments even before September 8th, depending on the population. I know that the Vermont chapter of American Association of Pediatrics did put out a statement really emphasizing the need for in-person education for up to fifth grade where possible and kids with special learning needs as well. And so I think, we are trying to just share everything we know as it comes. That is what's tricky about this whole pandemic. Because the science is continually emerging, it does feel frustrating, I know, to folks when we say, okay, get your plans in place. And then just as their plans are in place, we share more information. And it feels like, why wasn't that shared earlier? And sometimes, a month ago, we may not have had enough data to be able to confidently say, you know what, up to fifth grade, it's really low risk and we really advise it. And so where schools have the discretion, we're hopeful that they're able to look at this before opening. If not, maybe this becomes part of the evolution of thinking through September and October.
But the health department was saying several weeks ago that it looked like younger children don't transmit the virus as much, that they're less likely to contract it. So that messaging had been out. Is the signal here that the health department really wants schools and districts to reconsider any hybrid or fully remote learning plans?
We're not saying that message at this time. We're just providing information and continuing to have the discussion.
What about the health of the adults who work in these schools, many of whom say, yes, children may not transmit it as frequently, but you're asking, not you, the health department, but school districts are asking staffers who are adults to be in the building with other adults. And we've heard from many superintendents, including in yesterday's Vermont edition, that they're not confident that they have the staffing capacity for the plans that they have established for the fall. I mean, there seems to be a lack of direct communication to the adults who work in a school setting about their concerns about their health risks.
Yeah, and I would say if we were in Florida, Arizona, so many other states in the country right now, and we were talking about this kind of reopening, it would be, a really irresponsible decision to say, let's go back to school, let's get teachers in there. Vermont is in such a different place. We are really similar to some of the smaller European countries that have already tried back to school and haven't seen surges. And we are really at that level. And again, because this is very much a Vermont population, the kids going back to school, we're not going to have an influx of kids from across the country going back to our K through 12 schools. So it is a relatively protected population. It doesn't mean adults shouldn't be concerned. I absolutely understand the concern. And, you know, I've got two kids going back to school as well. But I would say that's the hard part. I think we're seeing so much from across the country that it looks like it's just a flame. And it's hard to look at that and not be afraid. But in Vermont right now, we are doing very well. Of course, we were ready to change course if we need to change course. Absolutely. But it is a much lower risk environment. And that's a huge part of why we're encouraging back to school.
Can you remind us why the health department, you know, Dr. Levine says this frequently, and we hear it from other health officials, that in weighing the risks of a return to school with other people in the building versus not returning to school, that some of the health risks seem to tip the scales in favor of returning to school. What are the health risks to young children of not being consistently in a school environment?
There are certainly mental health risks. The isolation for young children can be very difficult. For teenagers, we know that there is risk of depression. The isolation, we know that suicidality can increase. But also there's physical risk because it will be challenging for parents to be home as much as they're going to need to be home. I mean, honestly, even with the part-time return, it's still going to be hard. And so the lack of supervision could be challenging, and we could see more accidental outcomes, poor health outcomes. We could see an increase in risk behaviors, like drinking, like drug use. So there are those kinds of risks as well.
Drinking and drug use among the adults or among like teenagers?
Among teenagers, yeah. So I think Dr. Levine was referring to the health risks for the school population, the K through 12.
But I imagine you're also worried about, as we keep hearing, that there, with fewer mandated reporters being able to see children, there may be fewer reports of child abuse and neglect, but not necessarily fewer cases of it.
Yes. And so I was moving toward the kind of accidents at home, mm-hmm. the risk at home, and then, yeah, possible cases of abuse as well at home. And so there's a variety of things that happen when children are at home and when other adults don't have their eyes on them. Some of it is around that, and some of it could be also the kids' own behaviors, could be accidents, could be the mental and social isolation, the mental health related to that, but also, as you mentioned, child abuse. We know that that is a risk, and we don't catch it because, of course, people aren't seeing it.
Roger in Williston says, I own a retail location. Is this considered a private enterprise or is this a public space? Can I determine whether a customer can enter with or without a mask for the safety of my customers and my employees?
Yeah, I understand from the order that people who own stores can determine whether or not someone enters and they can prevent someone from entering their store and say, you can't. I believe.
Wait, but that was already, I mean, a retail establishment could already say you can't enter
that's
my
right.
place. With
yeah.
the mask
and I think
mandate.
That's what he's asking, right?
But with the mask mandate, could Roger say, yeah, you can come in without a mask?
Oh, I don't think so. But that might be more of a legal question that I'd have to check with legal on. It's my understanding that this is required. Now, again, we don't have a lot of enforcement, but this is required. And so, therefore, it's my understanding that a retail owner would not be allowed to independently overturn the governor's executive order in their retail establishment.
Okay, got it. And another question here from Peter, who's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I'm just wondering if it is any impact on folks dining in restaurants with a mask mandate. Obviously, they have to have masks on entering and leaving, but you can't dine when you have a mask on. What impact does this mandate have in that environment?
Thanks for the call, Peter. Tracy Dolan.
Sure. So like it existed already, but this now would apply to across Vermont, and I think it was existing in Burlington and some other municipalities, you have to wear a mask when you enter a restaurant. And once you sit down at the table to eat, you're allowed to have the mask off. I think there's more details on the ACC Day website about the restaurant protocol, but then putting it on again if you're going to the bathroom or if you're around others or as you leave.
Sidebar here. I loved it during the press conference when one of the reporters had a little misspeak and called it the ACDC website instead of the ACCD website. Deputy Commissioner, can you update us on where the state's investigation and conversations with federal officials stand on the discrepancy in the Manchester area between antigen testing, which revealed, I think, 65 people with positive antigen tests for COVID-19 versus a much, much lower number of those people who got a positive PCR test. And we're still trying to understand where that discrepancy lies and what the cause of it is. What can you tell us to update us?
I know that the FDA is doing an investigation. They're looking at the instruments, all of the supplies that were used, the methodology, the timing, and everything related to that. And we don't know what the outcome is yet, but I know that they are pursuing that now so they can understand where the defect or the challenge might be in that so that we don't have, this unfortunate result in the future.
So no hard and fast update yet, still to be determined.
That's right. As of yesterday, I saw that they were still mid-investigation.
In terms of testing and having the capacity to get everyone who wants a test, it used to be a problem that we didn't have enough tests. Now it seems like perhaps the state doesn't have enough pop-up testing or sites available to people. It's not necessarily the equipment. It's actually enough capacity for people who are saying, I need to be tested tomorrow, but who can't get into a pop-up test for another 7 or 10 days. How is the state doing in getting more private testing up and running at things like pharmacies and in accommodating everybody who wants a test to be able to get one?
One of the big limiting factors that's starting to come up now, it's amazing. It's like whack-a-mole a little bit. You know, you think you have one problem solved and then another problem that you thought had solved comes back up. So one problem now that we're seeing is really limited laboratory capacity throughout the country. So that's why we're seeing a slowdown in some of the results getting back. Labs now, because they have so much demand, are up to 7 or 8 days to get results back. So we have to be careful and preserve the lab capacity. And so what we're trying to do is really focus on those at highest risk, outbreaks, et cetera, those that are mandated to be tested. And so we're having to really think about that and at the same time look at our supplies and all the other pieces. So we're doing what we can, but we also need to make sure that those who need the tests the most are also able to get them.
So those who may be coming back from a hot county who could be tested in 7 days should anticipate that perhaps they may not be tested at that 7-day window and may actually need to quarantine for 2 weeks because of a lack of available testing.
That could be a possibility. We hope not, but that's certainly a possibility, especially with slow test turnaround times. It's possible that they'd be up to 14 days in some cases. Yeah.
Tracy Dolan is Deputy Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health. Deputy Commissioner, thank you very much for being here and fielding questions with us this hour.
Thanks, Jane, and you have a great day.
You too.